Then we'll need a closer look, Thrawn concluded. Signal the fighters to prepare for combat. Hyperspace course setting of 004x057. Once in place, they're to clear out the enemy fighters and create a defensive perimeter between the projector and the war vessels. The Springhawk will follow and attempt to retrieve the sphere. Assault teams 1 and 2 are to prepare for outhull operation, Thrawn said. There will most likely be an operational crew aboard the projector. They're to locate and neutralize with minimal damage to the projector itself. They'll be joined by Chief Engineer Yala Avikima and 3 of his crew, who will either find a way to collapse the projector to a size we can take aboard, or else attach it as is to our hull for transport. All groups are to signal when ready. 3 minutes later, the fighters and assault teams had all signaled their readiness. Stand by, fighters, Thrawn said, his eyes on the battle. Fighters, attack now. In the distance, there was a flicker of pseudo-motion, and the 6 Chiss fighters appeared in a loose line just off the projector's starboard side. Helm, prepare to follow. The enemy ships got off perhaps 2 shots each before the Chiss settled into their own counterattack, and the Vagari fighters began exploding. Less than a minute after their sudden arrival, the Chiss held the field alone. Alone, but not unnoticed. In the near distance, the 3 larger warships were beginning to respond, their aft batteries opening fire as they began ponderously turning around. Fighters, take defensive positions, Thrawn ordered. Helm, go. Cardass set his teeth. The stars began their usual stretch into star lines. Then, with a horrible-sounding thud from somewhere aft, the stars were back. Assault 1 to projector starboard side, Thrawn called. Assault 2 to port. Chief Yal Avikima, you have 5 minutes. Question is, do we have 5 minutes? Cardass muttered. I think so, Thrawn said. They'll need to be much closer before they can attack in earnest. Otherwise, they risk overshooting us and destroying their own projector. So? Cardass countered. Isn't that what they probably think we're trying to do to it? Actually, I suspect they're rather confused about our intentions at the moment, Thrawn said. An attacker whose sole purpose was destruction would hardly have had to move in this close. He gestured toward the battle. But whatever they perceive our plan to be, they still must allow the projector to remain functional as long as possible. Once the gravity shadow vanishes, the defenders inside its cone will be free to escape and possibly regroup. They thus cannot risk overshooting us, and must come in closer. The enemy warships had made it halfway around now, allowing them to bring their flank laser batteries into play. Still, so far, they did seem to be concentrating most of their fire on the Chiss fighters arrayed against them. And then, as the light of the distant sun played across the warship's sides, Cardass spotted something he hadn't noticed before. Hey, look, he said, pointing. They have the same bubbles all over their hulls that we saw in the treasure ship. Get me a close-up, Thrawn ordered, his eyes narrowing. On the main monitor display, the running series of tactical data vanished and was replaced by a hazy telescopic view of the bubble pattern. Cardass felt his throat suddenly tighten, as beside him he heard Maris's sharp intake of breath. Oh no, she whispered. The bubbles weren't observation ports, as Kanto had once speculated, nor were they navigational sensors. They were prisons. Each one contained a living alien being. All of them of the same species as the mangled bodies Cardass could see floating among the battle debris. Living shields, Thrawn murmured, his voice as cold and as deadly as Cardass had ever heard it. Can your fighters use their Connor nets? Cardass asked urgently. You know those things you used on us. They're still too far away, Thrawn said. At any rate, shock nets would be of little use against the electronic compartmentalization of war vessels that size. Can't they shoot between the bubbles? Maris asked, her voice starting to shake. There's room there. Can't they blast the hull without hitting the prisoners? Again, not at their distance, Thrawn said. I'm sorry. Then you have to call them back, Maris insisted. If they keep firing, they'll be killing innocent people. Those people are already dead, Thrawn replied, his voice suddenly harsh. Maris flinched back from his unexpected anger. But please, Thrawn said, holding up a hand. Understand the reality of the situation. The V'Ghari have killed them, all of them, if not in this battle, then in battles to come. There's nothing we can do to help them. All we can do is focus our resources toward the V'Ghari's ultimate destruction, so that others may live. Assault One reports V'Ghari crew has been eliminated, one of the crewers called. Chief Yal Avi Kima reports that they've located the projector's collapse points and are folding it for transport. Assault Two is assisting. Order Assault One to assist as well, Thrawn said. I thought there would be some sort of quickset arrangement, he added to Cardass. The V'Ghari wouldn't want to hold position for hours as they assembled their gravity projectors in full view of their intended victims. He looked back at the V'Ghari warships, their turns now nearly completed, and his mouth briefly tightened. Stand ready to fire on the war vessels. Cardass looked at Maris, but her back was to him, her shoulders hunched rigidly beneath her vac suit. Weapons ready. Weapons ready! Fire full missile bursts on my command, Thrawn said. His eyes flicked to Maris. And instruct the fighters to fire shock nets at the war vessel's bridge and command sections at the moment of minimum visibility. Acknowledged. Fire missiles, Thrawn ordered. Chief Yal Avi Kima, you now have 2 minutes. Chief Yal Avi Kima acknowledges and estimates the projector will be collapsed on schedule. Across by the distant warships, there were multiple flashes of light as the Chiss missile struck. Helmets! Someone barked. Cardass reacted instantly, snatching up his helmet and throwing it over his head, peripherally aware that everyone on the bridge was doing the same. He had locked the helmet onto its collar and was looking for the source of the threat when there was a sudden burst of light and fire, and the port side section of the canopy disintegrated. Through the deck, he felt the thud of airtight doors slamming shut, and for a fraction of a second, he heard the wail of warning alarms before the sudden decompression robbed them of any conducting medium. Blinking against the dark purple afterimage of the flash, he peered through the still swirling debris at the impact point. It was as bad as he'd feared. The three Chiss who'd been closest to the blast were lying twisted and crumpled on the deck. Other Chiss had also been thrown from their chairs, though most of them appeared to still be alive. He was still assessing the damage when Maris suddenly shoved past him, nearly knocking him off his feet, and dropped to her knees beside the command chair. It was only then that he saw that Thrawn, too, was lying on the deck, his glowing eyes closed, a violently fluttering tear in the chest of his vac suit leaking away his air. Commander! He snapped, dropping to the deck beside Maris and fumbling in a suit pocket for a sealant patch. Medic! I've got one, Maris said, a patch already in hand. Ripping off the protective backing, she slapped it against the torn fabric. For a moment it bulged with the remaining air pressure from inside the suit. And then, to Cardass's horror, one edge began to come loose. It won't bond to this material! Maris bit out, glancing around her. Help me find something to hold it! Frantically, Cardass looked around, but there was nothing. Never mind! Maris gritted. She pushed down the edges of the patch again, and then, with just a second of hesitation, she leaned over to lie chest to chest across his torso, pressing her stomach against the wound. Go get help! She ordered. Come on! This can't be doing his injuries any good. Breaking free of his paralysis, Cardass turned toward the door, and once again was nearly bowled over as two Chiss pushed past him, dropping to their knees on either side of their unconscious commander and the human lying across him. "Prepare to move," one of them snapped, a large patch gripped between his hands. "Move!" Maris rolled away. Almost before she had cleared the wound area, the Chiss had his patch in place, completely covering the one Maris had tried to use. She pushed herself completely away, and Cardass saw thin tendrils of smoke drift up from the edges of the new patch. "Sail good," the Chiss confirmed. The second crewer was ready, jabbing the hose of a hand-sized air tank into a valve built into the helmet collar. "Pressure stabilizing," he reported, peering at a row of indicator lights beside the valve. "Can we help?" Maris asked.
"You've already done so," the first Chiss said. "We'll handle it from here."
They had lifted Thrawn between them and were heading for the airtight door when the stars outside the canopy abruptly flashed into star lines. For the first 2 hours, the medics worked behind sealed doors, with no news coming out, and only fresh supplies and more injured going in. Cardass hung around the medbay area, trying to stay out of the way, occasionally being pressed into service to run errands for the staff. He didn't know at first what had happened to Maris, but from bits of overheard conversation, he eventually learned she was helping clear debris from the bridge. They were still 4 hours from home when the two of them were finally summoned into medbay. They found Thrawn, half lying, half sitting, on a narrow bed inside a set of biosensor rings that wrapped around him from neck to knees like the ribs of a giant snake.
"Cardass, Verassi," he greeted them. "I'm told I owe you my life. Thank you."
"It was mostly Maris, actually," Cardass said, not wanting to accept credit he didn't deserve. "She's faster in emergency situations than I am." "Comes of spending time with Rack on the Bargain Hunter," Maris said, trying a smile that didn't reach all the way to her eyes.
"How are you feeling?"
"Not well, but apparently out of danger," Thrawn said, studying her face.
"I'm also told you've been assisting with the task of clearing the bridge."
She shrugged self-consciously.
"I wanted to help.
Even after I launched missiles against the Vagari's living shields." She lowered her eyes.
"I'm sorry that I complained about that. I realize you didn't have any choice."
"Which doesn't necessarily make it easier to accept," Thrawn said. "It is, unfortunately, the sort of decision all warriors must make." "Did we get the gravity projector, by the way?" Cardass asked. "I never heard one way or the other." Thrawn nodded.
"It was collapsed and spark-welded to the outside of the hull just before we made our jump. All six of the fighters escaped as well."
Cardass shook his head.
"We were lucky."
"We had a good leader," Maris corrected.
"I'll kill her,"
Kento promised blackly as he glared at Maris and Cardass through the slotted plastic door of his cell.
"I ever get her alone, I swear I'll kill her."
"Just calm down," Maris soothed. "Tell us what happened."
"She tried to rob me, that's what happened," Kento bit out. "That stuff I picked out was ours. She had no business trying to take it away."
"And of course you told her so," Cardass murmured.
"I'd wash my mouth if I were you, kid,"
Kento warned, glaring at him.
"You may be teacher's pet here, but it's a long way back to civilization."
"So what happened to your collection?" Maris asked.
"She was going to take all of it with her," Kento said. "Luckily for me, that other Chiss, that Syndic myth-whatever..."
"Thrawn's brother?" Maris interjected. Kento's eyes widened.
"No kidding. Anyway, He decided he needed to hear Thrawn's version first, so he made her leave it behind. But then she insisted it be put under prescribed seal, whatever the frizz that means. So, bottom line is? Cardass asked. Bottom line is that it's locked away somewhere, Kento growled. And according to Syndic myth, whatever, even Thrawn can't get it out. We'll check with him, Maris promised. Come on, Georges. Let's see if the commander's accepting company. At first, the guard outside Thrawn's quarters was reluctant to even inquire as to whether the commander would see them. But Maris eventually persuaded him to ask, and a minute later, they were standing at his bedside. Yes, I saw Thras's report, he said when Maris had outlined the situation. Captain Kento needs to learn how to control his temper. Captain Kento needs to learn how to control more than that, Maris said ruefully. But being locked up has never done him any good before, and it's not likely to do anything now. Can you get him released? Yes. If you'll warn him about disrespecting Chiss command officers, Thrawn said. Perhaps we should simply lock him up whenever one is on the base. Wouldn't be a bad idea, Maris agreed. Thank you. What about the items your brother had sealed away? Cardass asked. Kento will be impossible to live with until he gets them back. Then it's time he began developing patience, Thrawn said. A syndic of the 8th ruling family has declared it sealed against a command officer's claim of possession. It cannot be unsealed until Admiral Ar-Alani returns to present her arguments. When will that be? Cardass asked. Whenever she so chooses. Behind Cardass, the door slid open. He turned, expecting to see one of the medics. So, warrior's fortune has finally failed you, Syndic Mithrasophis said as he strode into the room. Welcome, Thrawn said, beckoning him in. Please, come in. We need to speak, Thrawn, Mithrasophis said, eyeing Cardass and Maris as he stepped to the other side of his brother's bed. Alone. You need not fear their presence, Thrawn assured him. Nothing said will be repeated outside this room. That's not the point, Mithrasophis said. We have Chiss business to discuss, which is none of their concern. Perhaps not now, Thrawn said. But in the future, who knows? Mithrasophis' eyes narrowed. You think their thoughts will be of value? All thoughts are worth listening to, whether later judged to be of value or not, Thrawn said. But you came here with specific business to discuss. May my guests call you Thras, by the way? Absolutely not, Mithrasophis said stiffly. He looked at Maris, and his expression softened a little. Though I understand you saved my brother's life, he added reluctantly. I was glad I could help, Syndic Mithrasophis, Maris said in Chiyun. Mithrasophis snorted and looked at Thrawn, and the hint of a wry smile finally touched his lips. They really aren't very good at it, are they? You could try Minisiat, Thrawn offered. Or you could use Sibisti, which I believe you also know. Yes, Mithrasophis said, switching to an oddly accented Sibisti. If that would be easier. Actually, we'd prefer you stick with Chiyun, if you don't mind, Cardass said in that language. We could use the practice. That you could, Mithrasophis said. He hesitated, then inclined his head. And since you were both instrumental in saving my brother's life, I suppose it would be all right for you to call me Thras. Maris bowed her head. Thank you. We're honored by your acceptance. Thras turned back to Thrawn. Now, he said, his tone hardening again, what exactly do you think you're doing? The job for which I was commissioned. Thrawn replied, I am protecting the Ascendancy from its enemies. Its enemies, Thras said, leaning on the word. Not potential enemies. Do you hear the difference? Yes, Thrawn said. And no, Thras lifted a hand, let it slap against his thigh.
Let me be honest, Thrawn, he said. The Eighth ruling family is not happy with you.
They sent you all the way here to tell me that?
This isn't a joking matter, Thras spit out. That pirate treasure ship was bad enough, but this last escapade was far and away over all the lines, and right under an admiral's nose, too.
The Vagari aren't pirates, Thras, Thrawn said, his voice low and earnest. They're a completely nomadic species. Hundreds of thousands of them, perhaps millions. And sooner or later, they will reach the Ascendancy's borders.
Fine, Thras said. When they do, we'll destroy them.
But why wait until then? Thrawn pressed. Why leave our backs turned while millions of other beings are forced to suffer?
Thras sighed. Thrawn, you can't continue to push the lines this way, he said. Peaceful watchfulness is the Chiss way, and the 9 ruling families won't stand by forever while you ignore basic military doctrine. More to the point, the 8th family has made it clear that they'll release you before they permit your actions to damage their standing.
We were both born as commoners, Thrawn reminded him. I can live that way again if I have to.
For a long moment, the two brothers gazed at each other in silence. Then Thras sighed.
I don't understand you, Thrawn. I'm not sure I ever have.
Then just trust me, Thrawn suggested.
There, Sabaoth said, pointing through the viewport as their transport came around the curve of Yaga Minor.
You see it?
Yes, Lorana said, as she gazed at the massive object hanging in low orbit over the planet. 6 of the brand new dreadnought warships, arranged in a hexagon pattern around a central storage core. The whole thing tied together by a series of massive turbolift pylons. It's quite impressive.
It's more than just impressive, Sabaoth said gravely. Therein lies the future of the galaxy.
Lorana stole a furtive glance at him. For the past 3 weeks, ever since her official elevation from Padawan to full Jedi Knight, Sabaoth had been showing a marked change in attitude. He spoke with her more often and at greater length, asking her opinion on politics and other matters, opening up to her as if to a full equal.
The crews and families are already aboard, stowing their gear and making final preparations, Sabaoth continued. So are most of the Jedi who'll be accompanying us, though 2 or 3 are still on their way. You'll want to meet them all before we leave, of course.
Of course, Lorana said automatically, feeling her muscles tense as a horrible thought suddenly occurred to her. When you say we, are you expecting me to come with you on outbound flight?
Of course, he said, frowning at her. Why else do you think I recommended your elevation to Jedi Knighthood so soon?
A familiar tightness wrapped itself around Lorana's chest. I thought it was because I was ready.
Obviously you were, Sabaoth said. But you still have much to learn.
Here, aboard outbound flight, I'll have the necessary time to teach you.
But I can't go, Lorana protested. I haven't made any preparations. I haven't asked permission from the Jedi Council.
The Council has granted me whatever I need, Sabaoth cut in tartly. As for preparations, what sort of preparations does a Jedi need?
What about this one? Tarkosa asked, tapping his fingers on a rack of negative couplings.
Jazz? Just a second.
Ulyar growled, scanning the racks already in place as he silently cursed the crowd of tech assistants the Supreme Chancellor's office had sent from Coruscant to help with the loading.
It goes there, he told Tarkosa, pointing to a spot next to a rack of cooling pump parts. What in the worlds?
A deep voice said from behind him. Ulyar turned to see a balding, middle-aged man in a plain tan robe standing in the doorway.
"Who are you?" he demanded.
"Jedi Master Justin Manin," the other said, his forehead creasing as he surveyed the chaos in the room. "This equipment should have been stowed 2 days ago."
"It was," Ulyar said. "Very badly. We're trying to fix it."
"Ah," oh,
Manin said, a wryly knowing look on his face.
"Better speed it up. Master Sebaeth is arriving today, and he won't be happy if he sees things this way."
With a nod, he turned and headed off down the corridor.
"Like Jedi happiness is our problem," Ulyar muttered under his breath at the empty doorway.
"The entire system can be run from here," Captain Pac-Milo said, waving a flippered hand around the vast combined operations center. "That means if there's an emergency or disaster on any of the ships, countermeasures can be instituted immediately, without the need to physically send people to those sites."
"Impressive," Obi-Wan said, looking around.
Situated just aft of the cross corridor behind the bridge monitor room complex, the comm op center stretched probably 30 meters aft and filled the entire space between the dreadnought's two main bow corridors. It was currently a hive of activity, with dozens of humans and aliens bustling around, and half the access panels and consoles open for last-minute checks or adjustment.
"What's that thing?" Anakin asked, pointing to a low console 2 rows over from where they were standing.
"It looks like a pod racer control and monitor system."
"You have sharp eyes, young one,"
Pac-Milu said, his own large eyes rolling toward the boy.
"Yes, it is. We use it to control our fleet of speeders and swoops."
"You're joking," Obi-Wan said, frowning at the console. "You run swoops through these corridors."
"Outbound flight is a huge place, Master Kenobi,"
Pac-Milu reminded him. "While each dreadnought is linked by the pylon turbolifts to its neighbors and the core, there's still a great deal of travel involved where the turbolifts do not go. Speeders are vital for moving crewers back and forth in both emergency and non-emergency situations."
"I understand you'll be making a short tour through Republic space before you enter the unknown regions," Obi-Wan said.
"A sort of shakedown cruise, yes," Pac-Milu said. "We must confirm that our equipment is functioning properly before we go beyond reach of repair facilities."
He stepped to a nearby navigational console and touched a key. And a hollow of the galaxy appeared overhead.
"From here we go to Lonar in Droma Sector," he said, pointing. "After that, we'll cut through the edge of Glythe Sector to our guy in Haldim Sector. Then we'll travel through Kokash and Mondress Sectors, with a final stop possible in Albanan Sector, if it seems necessary."
"That's a lot of stops," Obi-Wan said.
"Most will just be flybys,"
Pac-Milu assured him. "We won't actually stop unless there are problems."
"What happens then?" Anakin asked.
"If all goes well, 3 weeks from now, we'll formally enter unknown space,"
Pac-Milu said.
"At a point approximately 230 light-years from the edge of wild space, we'll stop for a final navigational calibration."
His mouth tendrils wiggled as he shut down the hollow.
"And we'll then begin our journey in earnest, through the unknown regions and to the next galaxy."
Anakin whistled softly.
"How long before you'll get back?"
"Several years, at least," Pac-Milu told him. "But the storage core has supplies enough for 10 years, and we expect to be able to supplement its stores of foodstuffs and water along the way. In addition, our numbers may well diminish if we find hospitable worlds to colonize."
"You're not just going to leave people behind in the unknown regions, are you?" Anakin asked, frowning.
"If we do, it will be with enough food and equipment to get settled," Pac-Milu assured him. "We would also leave one of the dreadnoughts behind for defense and transport.
As you can see from outbound flight's design, it will be relatively easy to detach a single ship from the rest of the complex.
Anakin shook his head. Still sounds dangerous. We are well prepared, Pakmila reminded him. And of course we have 18 Jedi aboard. It will be safe.
Or at least as safe as one can be anywhere in these times, Obi-Wan murmured.
And it will be a glorious adventure as well,
Pakmila continued, eyeing Anakin.
A pity you will not be joining us.
There are still a lot of things I want to do here, Anakin said, an unexpected flicker of emotion coloring his voice and sense. Besides, I can't leave my master until my training is complete.
With 6 Jedi Masters aboard, you would have several choices of a teacher,
Pakmila pointed out.
That's not really how it works, Obi-Wan told him.
You said Master Sabaoth will be arriving soon.
He is, in fact, here.
Sabaoth's voice boomed from across the room. Obi-Wan turned. There, just entering the room, were Sabaoth and Lorana Jinsler.
This is a surprise, Master Kenobi,
Sabaoth continued as he strode casually through the bustle of activity.
I thought you'd be on your way back to Sularine by now.
I was relieved of that assignment, Obi-Wan said. There's something I need to discuss with you, Master Sabaoth.
Sabaoth nodded. Certainly. Go ahead.
Obi-Wan braced himself. Between Sabaoth and Anakin, this was likely to be unpleasant. Anakin and I would like to join the expedition. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Anakin turn to him in astonishment.
We would?
The boy asked. We would, Obi-Wan said firmly. At least to the edge of the galaxy.
And the final crew and passenger list, Captain Pakmila said, handing over the last data card.
Thank you,
Doriana said, accepting the card and tucking the entire stack away inside his coat.
And there's nothing else you need?
Nothing that I or 50,000 other people have been able to think of,
Pakmila said, with typically dry Mon Cal humor.
I believe outbound flight is ready to fly.
Excellent, Doriana said. Supreme Chancellor Palpatine will be pleased to hear it.
We couldn't have done it without his help,
Pakmila said gravely.
Please extend our gratitude one final time to him for all his efforts on our behalf.
I certainly will, Doriana promised.
Then that's that. Fly safely, and may the Force be with you. With 19 Jedi aboard, I'm sure it will,
Pakmila assured him.
Rather, 19 and a half.
Most definitely, Doriana agreed, keeping his smile in place as he frowned behind it.
19 Jedi and a half.
Goodbye, Captain.
He waited until the pilot had maneuvered the transport out of Dreadnought 1's forward hangar bay and had them skimming smoothly across the outer fringes of Yaga Minor's atmosphere before he pulled out Pakmila's passenger list and plugged it into his datapad. The last Jedi numbers he'd heard had put the total at 17, not 19. He pulled up the Jedi list and ran his eye down it. The names were very familiar. Most of them, potential troublemakers whom he himself had subtly nudged Sabaoth into inviting aboard his grand expedition. The first addition to the list, Lorana Jinsler, wasn't really a surprise. Doriana had always thought it likely that Sabaoth's former Padawan would decide to stay with him a while longer. The other two were Obi-Wan Kenobi and his Padawan, Anakin Skywalker. Doriana smiled to himself. So, Skywalker was Pakmila's half-Jedi. Cute. And an unexpected bonus for all his hard work as well. Their deaths aboard outbound flight would be nicely convenient. Outbound flight had disentangled itself from the last of its docking and support equipment now, and was making its ponderous way out of Yaga Minor's gravity well toward deep space. A minute later, as Doriana continued to watch through the transport's canopy, it flickered and vanished into hyperspace.
He looked back down at his datapad. Still, bonus or not, he'd better check with Sidious and let him know that Kenobi and Skywalker were aboard, just to make sure that fit in with the Sith Lord's plans. And he'd better check before outbound flight meandered its way out of the Republic. Forever. The shuttle took him to the Yavidari spaceport, a few kilometers from the preparation center, where all the preliminary work on outbound flight had taken place. He'd left his own ship berthed on the far side of the spaceport, in the restricted zone reserved for diplomats and high governmental officials. Passing through security, he headed through the maze of corridors to his docking bay. He keyed open the hatch and went inside, locking it again behind him, then made his way to the cockpit. Seating himself in the pilot's seat, he punched for the tower. "This is Kinmen Doriana, of Supreme Chancellor Palpatine's office." He identified himself when the controller answered. "Requesting a lift slot in 30 minutes." "Acknowledged, Master Doriana," the other said. "30-minute lift slot confirmed." "Thank you." Shutting off the comm, Doriana keyed for full ship startup, watching the displays closely as the systems began coming online.
"You are late, Master Stratus."
Doriana gave the displays one more leisurely look. Then, just as leisurely, he turned around. The Nymoidian was wedged half-hidden in the hollow alcove off the cockpit's aft bulkhead, glowering at him from beneath his short, five-cornered hat.
"Vice Lord Sive Cav," Doriana greeted him. "May I say how very uncomfortable you look?"
"Very amusing," Cav growled. "You should have been here an hour ago."
"Why?" Doriana countered calmly. "Isn't your fleet ready?"
"Of course it is."
"An outbound flight only just now left," Doriana said. "Plenty of time to set up our ambush."
He cocked his head slightly. "Or are you simply annoyed that I made you hide there in your little hole longer than you expected?"
"I was not hiding," the Nymoidian insisted stiffly. "I simply did not wish to be seen if someone from the spaceport authority came in unexpectedly."
"Then if you'll return to your cabin, I have a ship to fly. You have the fleet's coordinates for me?"
"Yes."
Cav's long fingers dipped into a recess of his robe and emerged with a data card.
"It will take no more than 2 days to reach them."
"Good," Doriana said. "That should give us time to finalize our attack strategy."
"I am the one trained in battle tactics," the other said stiffly. "The attack strategy will be mine."
"Of course," Doriana said, suppressing a sigh. "I meant only that I'd be available to assist you. Now, if you'll return to your cabin, we'll be on our way."
The Nymoidian drew himself up, and with his pride at least momentarily appeased, strode from the room. Shaking his head, Doriana crossed to the hollow alcove. Positioning himself in the alcove, he keyed for a holonet relay. The lights winked on, and he signaled for his master.
"Report."
"Outbound flight is on its way, Lord Sidious," Doriana said. "I have Vice Lord Cav aboard, and we'll be heading for the rendezvous within the hour."
"Excellent. And you know precisely where in the unknown regions outbound flight will be stopping?"
"Yes, my lord. Captain Pakmilu has 2 separate navigational checks planned for the first 800 light-years beyond Republic space. I have the coordinates of both."
"Be sure you take the first one. It may be that Sabaeth, in his impatience, will order the second to be cancelled."
"That is indeed my plan, my lord," Doriana confirmed. "One final matter. I have Pakmilu's final passenger listing, and 3 more Jedi have been added."
"One of them being Lorana Jinsla, no doubt."
"Yes, she's one of them," Doriana confirmed. "The others are Obi-Wan Kenobi and his Padawan Anakin Skywalker." Sidious's smile vanished.
"Skywalker? Who authorized this?"
"I don't know, my lord," Doriana said, feeling his heart starting to thud in his chest. The last time he'd seen Sidious like this, someone had died. Violently.
It must have been Sebaeth.
He cannot go on that ship. He must remain here. You will see to it.
Understood, my lord. Don't worry. I'll get him off. Doriana reached for the cutoff switch, his mind twirling as he tried to sort through the options.
Wait.
Doriana paused, his hand hovering over the control.
No, you continue with the plan. I will remove Skywalker from outbound flight.
Yes, my lord, Doriana said, wilting a little with relief. I'll contact you again when the mission has been accomplished.
Do that, Master Doriana.
Shutting down the holoprojector, Doriana went back to the pilot's chair and plugged Cav's data card into the reader slot. Time to find out exactly where they were going. The pylon turbolift car door opened into yet another spacious lobby area. Okay, Anakin said, leaning out for a look. And this one is... He threw a not-quite-surreptitious look at the marking on the side. Dreadnought 4?
Correct, Sebaeth said, putting a hand on the boy's shoulder and pressing him forward out of the car. We're now at the farthest side of outbound flight from the command ship, Dreadnought 1.
Rather like Tatooine in that respect, Obi-Wan added dryly. Right, Anakin said, only cooler and less sandy. Dreadnought 4's architecture and equipment, Obi-Wan noted, were identical to those of the other ships they'd visited on Sebaeth's tour. Not really surprising, considering how the expedition had been put together.
Jedi Master Justin Maning is in charge of this particular dreadnought, Sebaeth said as they headed aft. I believe you spoke with him at the first night dinner.
Yes, we chatted for a few minutes, Obi-Wan said. I thought Commander Omano was in charge of Dreadnought 4.
I meant that Master Maning oversees Jedi operations and activities, Sebaeth said. He should be back in Conference Room 5 with his two Jedi Knights and a select group of families. Let's go see how they're doing.
What were these families selected for? Obi-Wan asked.
The highest honor possible, Sebaeth said. Over the next few days, one of each family's children will be starting Jedi training.
Obi-Wan stared at him. Jedi training?
Indeed, Sebaeth confirmed. You see, along with their basic technical skills, prospective colonists were also screened for the presence of Force-sensitive children. Those families with the most promise were given preferential status, though, of course, we kept it a secret up until now. We have 11 candidates in all, including the three here in Dreadnought 4.
How old are these children? Obi-Wan asked.
They range in age from 4 to 10, Sebaeth said.
He cocked an eyebrow at Anakin.
Which is, I believe, the same age Master Skywalker was when you took him as your Padawan.
It is, Obi-Wan confirmed, feeling his lip twist. What about their parents?
What about them?
They've all given their permission for this training?
They will, Sebaeth assured him. As I said, giving a child to the Jedi is the highest honor possible.
So you haven't actually asked them yet?
Of course not, Sebaeth said, an edge of puzzlement creeping into his tone. What parent wouldn't be proud to have a Jedi son or daughter?
Obi-Wan braced himself.
But if for some reason they don't see it that way... Later, Sebaeth interrupted, gesturing to a door to their right. We're here.
The conference room was one of many mid-sized meeting areas scattered around a typical dreadnought. At the far end, standing beside a podium, was Jedi Master Maning, listening intently to a question from a woman in the front row. Flanking him, dressed in Jedi robes, were a pair of Duros. And seated in the rows of chairs in front of them, nearly packing the available space, were perhaps 40 men, women, and children. Far more than the three families Sebaeth had implied would be here. Sebaeth was clearly surprised, too.
What in the...
He rumbled under his breath, his eyes flashing as he looked around. Maybe they brought their friends? Anakin suggested hesitantly.
Friends were not invited, Sebaeth growled.
He started to move forward, then seemed to think better of it. Instead, he gave an impatient gesture to his right. Turning that direction, Obi-Wan saw Lorana Jinsler detach herself from the back wall where she'd been standing and walk over to them. She nodded in greeting as she reached them.
"Master Sabaoth," she said quietly, "Master Meneng said you might drop in on us."
"And it's fortunate that I did," Sabaoth said. "What are all these people doing here?"
"Master Meneng invited all the secondaries and their families as well," Lorana told him.
"Secondaries?" Obi-Wan asked.
"Those with a small amount of latent force sensitivity. Too small for them to ever become Jedi," Sabaoth said, glowering across the room at Meneng. "What about you, Jedi Jinsler? Why aren't you attending to your duties on Dreadnought One?"
"Master Meneng asked me to come," she said, her voice a little strained.
Sabaoth rumbled deep in his throat.
"I see."
Sabaoth strode down the aisle toward the front. Obi-Wan followed, Anakin and Lorana at his sides. As near as Obi-Wan could tell from the snatches of conversation he could hear, most of the people did indeed seem pleased or even excited by the fact that they had future Jedi in their families. Meneng nodded in greeting as the group approached.
"Master Sabaoth," he said. "Master Kenobi? Master Skye? What do you mean by bringing the secondaries to this meeting?"
Sabaoth demanded.
"I thought it would be useful to let everyone know at once why they'd been selected to fly an outbound flight," Meneng said. "Since the secondaries are the ones most likely to produce Jedi offspring in the future, I thought they should know what to expect." "That could have been dealt with if and when it happened," Sabaoth growled. "This is not how it should have been." "None of it is as it should be," Meneng countered. "Children this age? And taking them from their families by force?"
"By force?" Obi-Wan put in.
"I don't expect force to be necessary,"
Sabaoth insisted, glaring at Obi-Wan and Meneng in turn.
"The few parents who have doubts will undoubtedly come around. Certainly the children themselves will be thrilled to begin their training." "The question remains why we're even doing this," Meneng said. "We're doing this because we're setting off on a long and dangerous trip," Sabaoth told him. "We'll need all the Jedi we can get, far more than Master Yoda would permit me to invite." "Very well. So we'll raise them up by ourselves. And please don't quote me that learned nonsense about how young a Jedi candidate has to be, because that's all it is, nonsense."
"Master Yoda would disagree with you," Meneng said.
"Then Master Yoda would be wrong,"
Sabaoth said flatly.
"We don't train children or adults because we choose not to. That's the only reason."
He gestured at Anakin.
"Padawan Skywalker is proof that older children are trainable."
Meneng's lip twitched.
"Perhaps, but there are other reasons for accepting only infants." "What other reasons?" Sabaoth asked. "Tradition?"
"You do not approve of tradition?" one of the Duros asked.
"I don't approve of simply and blindly accepting it as truth," Sabaoth told him. "Nor can we afford to do so. The lists of Jedi are shrinking, Master Kiga, all across the Republic. If we're to continue our role as the guardians of peace and justice, we must find ways to increase our numbers." "By forcibly taking trainees from their parents?" Meneng asked. "Especially considering the fact that none of these parents had wanted their children to become Jedi in the first place." "But what about the child's wishes?" Sabaoth asked. "Wouldn't it be more ethical to allow him or her to make that decision?"
"But there are good reasons for accepting only infants," Obi-Wan said.
"Most of which don't apply here," Sabaoth said firmly. "There are no deep-rooted family hierarchies aboard outbound flight to deal with. Nor will the children be going hundreds or thousands of light years away to the temple on Coruscant, where their families will never see them again."
Beside Sabaoth, Lorana stirred but remained silent.
No, here there'll be merely a turbolift right away in the storage core,
Sabaeth continued.
After some initial training, we might even consider allowing them occasional evenings with their families.
You're putting them in the storage core?
Maning asked, frowning.
I want the training center as far away from noise and mental confusion as possible,
Sabaeth told him.
There's plenty of room down there.
Maning shook his head.
I still don't like this, Master Sabaeth. New ideas are always discomforting, as are new ways of doing things,
Sabaeth said, looking at each of the others in turn.
In many ways, all of outbound flight is a grand experiment.
And remember that if we're successful, we may return to the Republic with the key to a complete reinvigoration of the entire Jedi Order.
And if we don't succeed, Obi-Wan asked.
Then we fail, Sabaeth said stiffly. But we won't.
They were 6 standard days out of Yaga Minor and had stopped for a routine navigational check at Lonau System when the trouble started. A crowd had already gathered in the Dreadnought 2 aft passenger section when Obi-Wan arrived.
Let me through, please, he said, starting to ease his way through the mass of people.
Look, there's another one,
a Rodian muttered.
Another one what?
Obi-Wan asked, turning in that direction.
Another Jedi,
the Rodian said, looking him square in the face.
Easy, Feathen,
a man nearby cautioned.
Don't start pointing blame.
Can you tell me what happened?
Obi-Wan asked.
What happened is thieves in the night, the Rodian bit out. Thieves with robes and lightsabers.
Favine, shut up, the man said.
He looked at Obi-Wan, lowered his eyes.
They came for someone's kid, that's all.
In the middle of the night,
Favine insisted.
What night?
The man scoffed.
This is space. It's always night here.
The family was sleeping, Favine countered. That makes it night.
Thank you,
Obi-Wan said, easing away from them and continuing on through the crowd. Middle of ship's night or not, perhaps he ought to give Sabaeth the call. There was no need. He reached the open area in the center of the crowd to find that Sabaeth was already there.
Master Sabaeth, he said, taking in the rest of the scene with a glance.
Standing in the doorway to one of the rooms was a hulking figure of a man, his hands gripping the sides of the doorway as if daring anyone to pass. Behind him in the room was a frantic-eyed woman kneeling on the floor, clutching a young boy tightly to her. The child himself looked frightened, but also oddly intent. Sabaeth half turned to frown at him.
What are you doing here?
He demanded.
I heard there was some commotion, Obi-Wan said, crossing to the doorway.
Hello? He said to the man.
You're not taking him,
the other said flatly.
I don't care how many of you there are. You're not taking him.
You have no choice,
Sabaeth said flatly.
As Jedi Master Evrios explained to you nearly a week ago, your son is a potential Jedi, and he's agreed to enter training. That means he comes with us.
Says who?
The man retorted.
Ship's law says decisions about children are made by their parents. I looked it up.
Ship's law wasn't written to cover this situation, Sabaeth said. It therefore doesn't apply.
So now you just throw out the law when it doesn't suit you?
Of course we don't throw it out,
Sabaeth said.
We merely rewrite it.
Who does?
The man demanded.
You Jedi?
Captain Pakmilu is the final legal authority aboard outbound flight, Obi-Wan put in. We'll call him and ask.
He may be the final legal authority,
Sabaeth said, cutting him off with a warning glare.
That remains to be seen.
Obi-Wan felt an uncomfortable tingling across his skin.
What do you mean?
Outbound flight is first and foremost a Jedi project,
Sabaeth reminded him.
Jedi requirements therefore supersede all other authority.
Obi-Wan took a careful breath. May I see you for a moment, Master Sabaoth? In private?
Later, Sabaoth said, craning his neck over the crowd. Captain Pakmilu has arrived.
Obi-Wan turned to see the crowd opening up to let Pakmilu through.
Master Sabaoth, Master Kenobi, what is the problem?
They want to take my son away from me. The man in the door bit out. The boy is to enter Jedi training,
Sabaoth said calmly.
His father seeks to deny him that right.
What right?
The man snapped.
His right? Our right? Your right?
The Jedi are the guardians of peace,
Sabaoth reminded him.
As such,
maybe in the Republic you are,
the man cut in.
But that's why we're leaving the Republic, isn't it? To get away from arbitrary rules and capricious justice and...
Perhaps we should wait until morning to discuss this,
Obi-Wan interrupted.
I think we'll all be calmer and clearer of mind then.
There's no need for that,
Sabaoth insisted.
Master Kenobi speaks wisdom,
Pakmilu said.
We'll meet tomorrow after morning meal in Dreadnought 2's forward command conference room.
His eyes rolled to first the man, and then Sabaoth.
There you'll both have an opportunity to present your arguments, as well as relevant articles of Republic law.
Sabaoth exhaled loudly.
Very well, Captain, he said. Until tomorrow.
With a final look at the man and boy, he strode off, the crowd opening up even faster for him than it had for Pakmilu. Obi-Wan followed, making it through the gap before it closed again. For the first 100 meters, they walked in silence. Obi-Wan was starting to wonder if Sabaoth even knew he had tagged along when the other finally spoke.
You shouldn't have done that, Master Kenobi,
Sabaoth rumbled.
Jedi should never argue in public.
I was unaware that trying to clarify a situation qualified as arguing, Obi-Wan said, stretching to the Force for patience. Though if it comes to that, a Jedi should never deliberately antagonize the people he's supposed to be serving either.
Taking a child into Jedi training is not antagonism.
Doing so in the middle of the night is, Obi-Wan countered. There's no reason that couldn't have waited until morning.
He paused.
Unless, of course, you were deliberately trying to force the issue of control.
And why would I do that?
I don't know, Obi-Wan said. Particularly since the code specifically forbids Jedi to rule over others.
The Jedi Order has accumulated many rules over the centuries that are clearly erroneous. Why should this not be one of them?
Because Jedi aren't equipped to rule, Obi-Wan said. Because seeking power is the dark side.
And this is the engine compartment, Thrawn said, stepping aside to let Thras look through the access hatchway into the Bargain Hunter's engine room. You'll notice it has a radically different layout from those of Chiss vessels this size.
Yes,
Thras said. He peered inside a moment, then turned to Cardass.
What's the vessel's sublight range?
I'm not sure, Cardass said, looking over at Kento. The other was standing off to one side with Maris, who was whispering a running translation to him.
Rack?
He invited in Basic.
Why?
Kento growled.
Is he looking to take it for a test run or something? Come on, Rack.
Cardass cajoled, carefully avoiding Thrawn's eyes.
We can do 600 hours of sublight before refueling,
Kento said grudgingly.
650, if we're careful with our acceleration.
Thank you. Switching back to Minisiat, Cardass translated for Thras.
Impressive,
the Syndic said, taking another look at the engine compartment.
Their fuel efficiency must be slightly better than ours.
Yes, but their hyperdrives appear to be more fragile,
Thrawn said.
Our shocknet attacks disabled both theirs and their attackers without difficulty.
Weaponry?
Simple but adequate, Thrawn told him.
The equipment is difficult to get to, but my experts have studied it at length.
Their energy weapons and missiles are less sophisticated than ours,
and they don't carry any shock nets or other disabling equipment. On the other hand, bear in mind that this is merely a small private freighter.
True.
Thras looked at Cardass.